I did that most annoying thing and arrived with something else to add to the service this morning, which is a photograph, which I want to show you now. So we arrived in Haxby in September 2017, and not long after, just a few months after, we had the Brexit vote. And amongst the casualties of the Brexit vote was a recognition of the abundance of language. I was working at the university around the time that the Brexit vote took place, before it was enacted. And I remember the Vice Chancellor was from Belgium. His name was Kuhn. I was one of the only people who could say his name properly, which he appreciated. And I saw him the day after and said to him, "How are you?" And he was quite shocked and quite shaken. And I saw him a few weeks later, and he said that he and his family had been eating in a restaurant in York with friends from Belgium. And someone came over to them and said, "You need to speak English now." My favorite story post-Brexit is of a young Muslim woman talking to her child on a bus in Wales. And a large white man walking over to her and saying, "Listen, love, you need to speak English now." And she said, "Actually, I'm speaking Welsh." So we've just had the 20th anniversary of our Haxby and Wigginton Scarecrow Festival. We had over 150 scarecrows across the community. We raised over £6,000 for four charities. It was a brilliant weekend. And every year we've had a scarecrow at the manse. And the first year that we were there, so this was 2018, this was our scarecrow. My brother-in-law is an occasionally legal graffiti artist. He has had commissions from local councils and city councils in Germany to, with his friends, go and spray murals on underpasses and, you know, do some artwork. But most of his graffiti is done by Doc, though not so much anymore. And we asked Dave if he would do that banner, the scarecrow banner, for us on a sheet, which he did. And you can see he's done it brilliantly. We manufactured the dude doing the spray painting. And then a few weeks before the festival, I wrote a short email that I sent to our three primary schools, and I put one post on social media in the Haxby Facebook group, and discovered effortlessly within a matter of hours that by the time the festival began, we could confidently as a family say there were at least 13 first languages spoken in Haxby and Wigginton. And Haxby and Wigginton is a lovely community, but I will say it bluntly, it is as white British as you could imagine when you walk through it. By the end of the festival, there were nearly 20. We got to 19 because people came and knocked on the door and said, "You've left one out." The question on the sheet, because there's a question, was how many first languages are spoken in Haxby and Wigginton? You would not believe how many people said 12 because they counted all the signs on the grass and forgot the English, which is ironic in its own way. 13 first languages, 19 by the end of 3 days. Probably more by now. We'll just leave that up while I'm preaching. Pentecost. We read the story, and we focus often on the conversions, on the miraculous nature of the story, on the spectacle that it must have been if it happened exactly as is written. We talk about what it means. We talk about what it symbolizes. We talk about it theologically in the way that God comes to dwell very powerfully, clearly in the disciples in this moment. But I want to ask today, what about the experience of Pentecost? What about the experience of Pentecost for the disciples? And I want you to imagine opening your mouth and Phrygian or Pamphylian or Egyptian or Median or any of those languages just coming out. If we imagine the story as it is, I don't think that the disciples would have gone, "Well, this is fun. Yeah, let's do some more of this." It must have been bewildering, even frightening. Remember, they've been hiding behind locked doors for days. They step out into the crowd. Nervous. They must have been self-conscious. Did they know what they were saying? And then what about the experience for those who heard them? Did they hear a propositional argument for God in their own language and go, well, I'll have some of that, I'm going to sign up? I don't know many people at all who've been converted by a propositional theological argument for God. But to hear someone say something about being loved and accepted and at home, whatever we want to imagine the gospel really has to say to us about our place in God's life, imagine hearing that as a foreigner, as a stranger, in a place where your rights are tenuous, your welcome is conditional. For those who heard, would they have been surprised? Would they have been appreciative? Would they have felt included in a way that they didn't before that? Our buildings speak a language. We have chairs in rows facing a table, a pulpit, a lectern, things that are very familiar to us. But they speak a language. And from the front, there is someone who will usually drone on for a little too long. You have been warned. And our activities speak a language. We sing historical songs on the whole with sometimes obscure words. Do you ever have that experience where you're singing in a hymn and you think, everyone else knows what this means. I don't have a clue. It must just be me. There's nothing wrong with the songs. They are part of our idiom. They're part of our language. They're precious to us. We do this odd thing, kneeling at a rail where someone hands out hundreds of tiny little glasses. I still maintain that if you want to know who the greatest sinners are in any Methodist church, ask who the treasurer is, and then ask who washes the communion glasses. Because I can't imagine two jobs I would rather not do than those. I joke, but it is an odd thing. When you know that you do it and you've done it for maybe your whole life, it is not an odd thing. But on its own, it is a language. It is an idiom. It is a culture and a practice that is obscure. However much we might feel we could explain it. And then, so much language about forgiveness. So much that seems wrapped up in the idea of being loved in spite of ourselves, not because of ourselves. Or there being some more balance in that. Prayers for others. I wonder what it's like for someone who's never been in a church to come into a church and listen to the prayers of intercession and wonder exactly what we're doing. Because it sounds like we're telling God what the things are that we would like God to get stuck into and intervene in the world. But of course, we must always begin with all of the prayers that are unanswered and the places that are just awful and the human experiences that are intractable and unchanging, and wonder where God might be in all of that if we just take those things at face value. We read stories from an ancient book that is hard to understand, a book that is hard to reconcile as a single text that says all that God has to say in sacred writings, as though this is everything there has ever been to say about God that we should read from here. You see, I'm really sure in my reading of the gospel that Jesus places the outsider, the stranger, central to the gospel. Parable after parable, story after story, decision after decision about where he is going to be himself physically, amongst which people, doing whatever things are abhorrent to the purity laws of his Jewishness. The stranger, the outsider, is central to the gospel. So let's spend a moment with these same things and wonder what the outsider might make sense of them with. So, I was in a workshop a while ago, a kind of wider Methodist workshop, and I dared to suggest that the church might get somewhere with some people because we don't sing. Because singing is weird. Singing with other people is a very niche thing to do. Maybe you've never thought about that. You know, if we look at football stadiums, I mean, lots of people are singing. Yeah, there are 80,000 people, well, quite a lot today, because it's the last day of the Premier League. Lots of people singing all kinds of songs, but where else do we sing? Carols? You join a choir? If it's your thing, you sing. But if you don't, can I suggest if you're under 40 years of age, even your school experience might not have included any communal singing, apart from music lessons that you endured, or that you wished could take the place of maths or something else. But singing is an odd thing. It is a foreign language for lots of people. Singing with strangers is an odd thing. Not a bad thing, but it's an odd thing. When we say, as part of our worship, that everyone is welcome to come forward for communion, we're proud of that. We're a tradition that doesn't say there is any barrier to anyone coming to receive communion, that it is about the death of Jesus. And the way that we tell that story really matters, because for someone who comes in and sits down and doesn't understand what it is that we're doing, it does feel as though we're telling a story of God self-harming and bloodletting in order to stop hating us and loving us again. We have to be very careful with that story. The symbolism in our church. I did a funeral while I was at the university for a Chinese student who died. It's a tragic story. She died in a road accident, and the person who was driving the car was prosecuted because he was over the limit. And her family came across from China. Her father was unbelievably connected somehow in the Chinese government, because the consul general was on campus for 3 days. And I sat in a meeting where, through an interpreter, when we had to say to the family there'll be a delay because a second inquest was required for the defense, for the person who was being prosecuted, the father patiently asked a humble question, and the translator said, would it make any difference if we phoned the Prime Minister's office? And the university had to say no. It's a legal process. But I walked around Heslington Church with Wendy's father. Her name wasn't Wendy at birth, but her family had given her the name Wendy when she came to university as a kind of gift to go and live in an English country. A lot of Asian students and families do that. And I walked around with Mr. Wang and the interpreter. And we paused at one point, Mr. Wang asked the interpreter a question. And the interpreter turned to me and said, Mr. Wang just wants to make sure that he's got the symbolism correct. So it's God, the baby, and the pigeon. Which on one level is quite funny. But why would you not think that, looking around, when we have the imagery we have? It is confusing and difficult. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but it is a language that we are fluent in or wrestling with, that others may not be. This, less so in Methodist churches, but this ongoing saying sorry for being ourselves, It is genuinely a barrier to people from outside of our churches. Not because they think they don't make mistakes, but because there are so many people who live in the world believing that there is fundamentally goodness in us. Quakers teach us that, if we want to get religious. And who struggle with churches and what seems like a preoccupation in communion and Easter with forgiveness and the need for us to somehow appease God, rather than meet God in our goodness, as limited as it might be, with all of our faults and failings. And then when it comes to praying, how it is that we ask God to intervene, or sound like we are doing that? Where is the evidence of love, if that's part of the answer to this world, which just gets messier and messier? And then the Bible, which is confused and confusing. And if we read little bits here and there, we can make some sense of it. Perhaps books on their own, but when you read across Scripture as a whole, God is enormously different in character and relationship and language even. How do we make sense of that? How do we share that with that complexity and the wrestling with that with strangers, with outsiders, in a way that is inviting? So I want to ask this morning, and I'm going to ask you a number of questions. If you'd been in Haxby for any length of time, you would know that I love asking questions that I don't answer and just leave with you. But I really want to ask us today, if we're going to be true to Pentecost, what the story is, what it does, What if our language doesn't meet or serve the stranger? What if it doesn't? What would Jesus ask of us if we were of the opinion, if we came to the realization that a lot of our language as church does not meet the needs of or serve the stranger, or even invite them necessarily as much as we'd like to believe it should? What should we prioritize? What do we love? What is part of even our identity as individuals or as a tradition or as a local church that we might need to let go of, cease doing? You know, all of those conversations at circuit level and in local churches, they're often about buildings, letting go of buildings. But we don't often talk about letting go of our language or aspects of it, which are causing, in some ways, maybe the decline that causes the problems we have maintaining our buildings. While we believe that we would always be welcoming as people, what would make our buildings more welcoming, more relevant and appropriate to the languages of our community? What imagination might we bring to bear? Thank God we're not a tradition that consecrates things. Yeah? That has somehow got a bishop, and I don't say this unkindly, to come and make that table more than a table, so that we can't get rid of it because there's something about it that isn't just a table. We have the freedom to be playful in these things. A little while ago, at Haxby, one of the supernumeraries in our circuit led a service and gave the congregation four letters. Four letters. And the letters were I, E, L, and V. And I asked the congregation to make up words with those letters. So come on, if you've been paying attention. I, E, L, and V. What have we got? Live. Evil.
Vile.
Veil. We kind of run out there. And keep trying over coffee if you're one of those people who does those. How many words can I find with the letters? But the congregation came up with evil and live and veil, which all have images for us in Scripture. But a couple of you have said vile. And I want to spend just a moment with that word, vile. See, today is also Aldersgate Sunday. It is the Sunday closest to John Wesley's, not, I wouldn't say his conversion, I'm not sure exactly how he describes it, because the language is quite flowery. But his moment of realization that God loved him for him, that God was in his heart and in his life, and that it wasn't doing lots of things with the best intentions and the most earnest faith that was going to ever be what God had created him to be. Very powerful moment. On April the 2nd, in 1739, having travelled with his own deep struggle as a sacramental Anglican, a high Anglican, who did believe in consecrated altars, who did believe in church buildings somehow being physically different spaces from the rest of the world, that those were the appropriate place for worship, for preaching to happen, for lots of things to happen. Having been encouraged by others who were doing the same, speaking outdoors, he wrote these words. At 4 in the afternoon, I submitted to be more vile and proclaimed in the highways the glad tidings of salvation, speaking from a little eminence in a ground adjoining to the city to about 3,000 people. Now that's quite a voice, never mind other things. But I want to pause on that language. I submitted to be more vile. I went against myself, what I believe, what I hold precious, what I have received and inherited, that is somehow immutable, that is bigger than me, that is to be maintained and upheld as the church and its practices. I submitted to be more vile. This wasn't just a moment where the lights came on for Wesley. Wesley joins the disciples in the imagined experience of Pentecost because it's hard for him. It's hard for him to do this. And it's hard for him to keep doing this. He doesn't preach to 3,000 and then think, well, this works, and just, you know. he continues to wrestle with this. He and his brother continue to wrestle with the way that they want hymns to be theologically instructive to people who have no experience of God and who then use what were profane tunes in some ways to help them know at least what the tune is while they learn the words. All of these things, compromising. Compromising all that they felt they'd inherited and should perhaps uphold. It's not easy. It's not easy learning other languages. It's not easy giving up our own when it's precious to us. But just 2 months later, in June of 1739, John Wesley wrote these words. I'm not sure who he wrote them to, but today they are for you. Oh, may you also be vile, exceedingly vile, for God's sake. Forbid that you should ever be other than generally scandalous. How's that for a way to go out into the week? Oh, may you also be vile, exceedingly vile, for God's sake. God forbid that you should ever be other than generally scandalous. See, Pentecost is not some solemn commemoration of an extraordinary moment for a few. It is about a conviction and a growing ability to learn the language of our day while we discover God alive within us. That is what the disciples underwent. So I tried to heal the photocopier. I've done a reasonable job. I still, as an engineer in my past, maintain that if you can't make it in any other field of engineering, you design photocopiers. I'm clear about that. But again, the questions that Alex has for you are part of a circuit process about working out how you begin in September with some reorganizing, and I want to say two things about that. It really matters. It really matters in terms of our relationships with each other across churches. It really matters in terms of our relationships with each other across churches. But I also want to say, it really doesn't matter at all to God or to our communities unless whatever we begin, however you begin, with whatever ministers you have, in whatever teams and with whatever relationships, formal and informal, with other places, unless it forms part of the work of the gospel, unless it begins with a stranger at the center, and all of us are in it in an ongoing, lifelong language school, doing our best to not just speak with, but listen to the culture and the questions and the longings and the worries and the struggles and the pressures and the desires of as many people as we can. And not each other. Not first. I don't think the gospel allows it. As much as we love and care for each other, if our decisions begin with each other, we have in some way stepped away from the gospel. So I want to ask you this morning, how can good news be good news if we insist on speaking and showing it in an essentially antiquated foreign tongue? What we do is precious. The way we do it matters. But Pentecost is about the uncomfortable, bewildering, confidence-finding, learning to listen to and speak to our communities in languages, whether they are words or behaviors or patterns or architecture, times of the week when we gather, the things that we think are most important, the places we take our faith, that are about the gospel. So I've left you with lots of questions. You're probably exhausted. But let's not just tell a story about some other people long ago who somehow got us here today, as though we are sure that this and the way we do it is exactly what God would have us be and do at this moment in our world.